Welcome to Fired Up, where you find your conservative talk of the day, where we tackle the hottest topics with a fiery spirit. In today's episodes, we're diving into a trio of stories that are sure to spark some debate. First up, California is rolling out a plan to give undocumented immigrants access to taxpayer-funded home loans. Yes, you heard that right. Your hard-earned dollars might just help someone else buy a home. It's a bold move that's raising eyebrows and questions about priorities in the Golden State. Then we turn our attention to Mark Zuckerberg and Meta, who's finally saying, oops, for censoring conservative voices on social media. It seems the tech titan is learning that silencing dissent isn't the best way to foster a healthy dialogue. Who knew? And finally, if that wasn't enough, California's government is now eyeing control over the news media because nothing says free press like a little government oversight, right? So buckle up, folks. We're about to unpack these hot button issues and more right here on Fired Up. Everybody, once again, I am William De Pilar. This is Fired Up, and let me get right to it and introduce my regular, what do we call you guys, regular panelists? What would they say on Match Game? Remember Match Game? You know, they'd have their regular panelists. I don't know, but first up,
we have just said Peanut Gallery.
There you go, G. Mangani. G, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, my name is G. Mangani, and I'm a school board member, elected official over here in Rancho Santa Fe School District. And that's my volunteer position. My day job is software consultant. So.
There we go. And we have, you know, Annette, when I see Annette Ross, I'm sure other people have told you, I just think Betsy Ross. I don't know why, but that's what comes to mind. Tell us a little bit about yourself, Annette.
Seriously, no flags over here that I'm sewing. Writer and disability advocate. I'm also current president of the Rancho Santa Fe School Board elected official and going for another run in this coming up election.
Outstanding. We need good people on any school board. So I think I wish we could have people like you guys on more of the lower, you know, boards where there are, it's not the, what's the term, the politically correct term, you know, the poor districts, you know, those boards tend to be more bought by school, by teachers unions than anything else, where your board seems very much independent. I mean, am I wrong in that thought process?
Not at all. I believe that a lot of people move to our district because we run the school district, the board does, and not any special interest groups. We have pretty good governance over our curriculum and how the school operates, and I think people love that about the way Annette and I and our fellow board members run things.
Good. That's always good to hear. Hopefully that can extend to other boards. But let's get right to it. We got a very serious topic. I don't know, Annette, if you were referring to this one, that it's a very complicated issue, but anything with California politics can be complicated. And that is the fact that, in a nutshell, I'm saying this wrong, but in essence, California is now going to put on the taxpayers' ability for illegals to purchase a home. That's not necessarily 100% true how I said it. They're going to be able to qualify for loans. It expands something called the California Dream for All Shared Appreciation Loan Program. It allows illegal immigrants, is a politically correct term, but by definition, the illegal aliens to apply for first-time home buyer loans, offers loans up to 20% of home purchase. It requires repayment upon sale. There's a lot of technicalities into it. But it's, in essence, they're going to be covered, and G, correct me because you have some data on this, 20% of the loan will be covered by the taxpayers. Is that correct? And we'll start with you on that. What are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. It's 20% up to $150,000, and it is the lottery system. This actually has existed for I don't know how many years, but it's a lottery system so that those who apply, you don't automatically get it. You're chosen. So I believe last year 18,000 Californian families applied, and only 1,700 got it. So less than 10%. What this recent AB 1840 did was basically include illegal immigrants into that pool as well. So I don't know, remember the first name of the assemblyman, but it was Arambola is the last name, and he decided that it's inequitable to exclude people who shouldn't be here in the first place. Now, what is that going to do? Like, okay, so if you throw, we use the numbers that I used for this year, and I believe the funds ran out in the first week or two of January. And only less than 10% of those who applied, Californian American citizens, Californian residents, got it. So less than 10%. Let's say you allow now undocumented workers to also apply, and let's say double the size of the pool. Well, now you'll have 5%, presumably, if we use my numbers, of California residents getting access to this money, and 5% of illegal immigrants and families getting access to this money. So I don't think it's a good policy in general, because what happens is if you give free money to anybody, your new zero is that dollar amount, right? So
right.
If everyone gets $12,000, then $12,000 a year in universal basic income is now the new zero, and everything goes up accordingly in price. And I think the policy that Biden put into place, where he was handing out money during COVID, and to be fair, Trump did too, that caused massive inflation, right? So what we're going to see with these homes is these homes continue to go up in value way beyond the price or the rate of inflation here in California, and it's getting more and more unaffordable. And so the solution is not to give people more money so they can bid up the price of homes even further. The solution is to build more homes.
And correct. In fact, you made a great point there. I wish Big John was part of this panel. He knows all these types of numbers. But I remember during the Clinton era, going back to the 90s now, he created a program to make it much easier and much more affordable. And when we sold our first home in 1997, 98, it's like we sold it at 100% value. And as we were getting ready to close it, we got an offer for even more. Now, me being a moron, I said, look, I gave my word, so I'm not going to break my word. You know, I'm going to sell it. Keep, you know, I promised this couple. Big John, it was called a Community Reinvestment Act. And but my point in this is it caused a market crash, you know, with the big balloon payments and things like that. So I'm not sure. But when I was reading this, I'm like, that's what kept coming into my mind. So I don't know how right I am, but that's one of my fears. So, Annette, if you want to chime in on that point, feel free. But I wanted to ask you is, what do you think about this setting a precedent for other states and overall implication of future? I mean, none of us see this going well. So I think this could not only create a collapse of sorts, but then it could hurt other people, actual constituents who do need these loans. You know, so what are your thoughts on that?
Well, gee, I just want to commend you. You're really good. You broke that down very well. And that was very helpful to hear your explanation. I guess when I was reading about this today, I was just more sad about how they're using the American dream. Because where I grew up in Chicago, there's a bunch of different neighborhoods, Irish neighborhood, Polish neighborhood, little Italian neighborhoods on the south side of Chicago. And all of these people who got to this country because of maybe their parents who got here legally, worked extremely hard in whatever craft they had or whatever jobs they could pull together, and how the families and communities worked together so they could actually purchase a home, because there was such a thing, I think, through that really hard grinding work that people did to make their families and the future families better, really meant something. I think those people that I grew up with and remember and know would be disappointed about these types of handouts because of the efforts and the hard work that they put in to make the dream come true. And I guess I thought about it more, not in an economic way that G did, but more of a philosophical way. It sounds like a soundbite. Sounds really great. Sounds like someone's trying to say, we're keeping the American dream alive. But is it really? You know, that's what they're, it's sort of like trying to evoke that feeling. And what is lost in all of that is there are ways to be here legally. I mean, that should be the conversation. And there are ways to still make the American dream come true. And I'm not saying, because I completely believe, I think I said it in other podcasts, in neighbors helping each other. We talked about that with the homeless and people helping each other. So I'm a big proponent of that. But I think this is not the way to go about it.
Right. In fact, I would counter to people who say that you're crushing the American dream. I have friends, my wife and I have friends, we are working class people, most of our circle are working class. I've got friends who have done very well, but most of our everyday friends tend to be working class, you know, they have to watch their P's and Q's. And there's some of them who still don't own a home. And many decades ago now, I realized, I was like, oh my God, you know, I may have complained about serving. We always complain in the military about how miserable our lives are, but God bless the fact that I was able to get a home through the GI Bill, not the GI Bill, the veterans, as somebody who served, you know, we don't have to put a down payment. The government covers that for us. I didn't realize how lucky I was. I mean, and now it's next to impossible. So when I say they're crushing the American dream, for somebody whose dream is to own a home, and they're not only crushing it this way, they're also crushing it through indoctrination, through teaching kids, you really don't want a home because of this, this, and this. And there's kids who don't want to own a home. I'm like, where are you coming from? But they're crushing the dream because they don't have enough for the down payment. And now illegals are being helped more than the constituent. And it's not just, I don't want to get into it, but the other costs. My wife just showed me our electric bill for this month, over $700, you know? And I'm like, oh my God. What about people who live check to check, who do have those McDonald's jobs, two jobs? What the hell are they going to do? So the thought process of seeing illegals being helped and not paying into the system, these are all complete lies that you hear from people saying how they pay their fair share of taxes, the crime rate, they don't do as much crime. All those are deceptive numbers. If you actually know numbers, you know the how those lies are portrayed. It just seems that we're putting those who aren't even citizens ahead of the tax, hardworking tax-paying citizen. So, Gene, you already talked on this a little bit, but the address to get to the question a little bit more. Does the inclusion of illegal aliens in this program adequately address the housing crisis, or does it potentially create more problems than it solves? You kind of partially gave that answer, but if you can just I want to make it an actual point here.
Yeah, no, I was looking at a graph of commercial real estate, and commercial real estate in the suburbs, meaning office space, is going down at a much slower rate than commercial real estate in the center of cities, right? Which means that businesses are, well, a lot of people are working from home now, but where businesses are moving to are in the suburbs. So those home values will, I don't know if they'll continue to rise. I can't predict the market. Real estate does not always go up. But people are willing to move further out, right? So California is a big state. I mean, if you took the whole population of the whole world and you put them shoulder to shoulder, they'd fit on the island of Maui. I mean, the world is a big place. And even though we have a lot of people, California is a huge place. We have plenty of room to build. And so you can create these more further inland places to build more homes, more commercial real estate, more businesses can move there. If they want to do business in California. And that would solve the issue, right? So then you have more supply that exceeds the demand, and prices won't go as high, but that would benefit those who are renting or who don't own, and at the expense of those who do own. But, you know, this is a free market. We're not trying to pick winners or losers, except for this bill, which is trying to pick winners. This is just going to create more problems, but it's more demand. The supply is still constrained. Prices are going to continue to go up. And the ones playing by the rules, again, I said 90% did not win the lottery to get this money. 90% lose out. And now they're faced with higher prices and higher rates as well.
But, you know, Gene, in this case, I would push back and say they are picking winners and losers. They're putting the American citizen, the California constituent, the hardworking taxpayer under the bus by putting those who don't pay into the system as much and who came into this country illegally. And, people, I don't hate illegals, but there's a right way to come to this country. And you can't just flood the system, because flooding the system means you're putting pressure on our, what's the word, on the system that helps take care of people who are struggling. You're taxing it. And there's just not enough money, so they keep raising the prices. And the other point I would push back on is people aren't willing to move further out. They're being forced to move further out. I would sit there and wager that those people who live in Riverside and commute to San Diego aren't commuting because they love the neighborhood they're in Riverside. That's where they can afford to buy a house. I bought my house. It turns out my house was a tax lien, and I figured that out looking at it because it was such a great deal. But the one reason it was such a great deal is because I live in Valley Center, which is a little bit not, you know, it's more the country. I don't mind. I love the country life. But, you know, where I made the choice to buy a house here, a lot of people are forced to. They have to deal with CEQA, and then there's regulations on top of CEQA. And here's how it goes to Americans out there listening to the show. A developer will spend years getting the various boards approved subdivision, say 3,000 homes. They've already budgeted the legal costs for the next 10 years of court fights. And then they have to deal with the local regulations and the local property taxes. It gets to the point where 40% of the cost of that house is paid up front by the developer before a shovel is put into the ground. So it's a complete mess. And now we're asking the taxpayer to pay.
And I believe the total cost of building a home right now is somewhere in the neighborhood of $400,000. So that's the floor.
That's the floor for low income housing. You know, and that's the other thing is for people out there, when you build a division, 10% of it has to go to lower income. The problem is that lower income isn't going to lower income people. Middle class people are barely able to get into those homes. So, and I learned all this when I got elected and served on the planning group. It's like, you know, and it's just so overwhelming. And then they blame you. Where, you know, it's like homes that have been approved, divisions that have been approved 20 years ago, and we're still working out details with the developers and how they'll look, what, you know, more of the surface type stuff than the actual homes, yet we get blamed. So I do push back against my own constituents. I have told a couple of older constituents, where were you 20 years ago when this was an actual issue, but you're complaining now? I get some cojones to one older lady. She said, "Well, I was busy working, so it's your job today to take care of me." That's obviously completely wrong, but she has some brass cojones that don't know. I was on the phone at 7 in the morning when she had called my personal house phone. The brass was on it. So Annette, looking at there will be potential legal challenges. We're not lawyers. I haven't stayed in a Holiday Inn in a long while. But there's constitutional concerns, violations of federal immigration law, questions about state authority providing benefits to illegal aliens ahead of constituents. There's equal protection issues, taxpayer lawsuits, possible federal intervention because we're talking illegals here. So my point isn't to let's dissect each one of these as much as this isn't quite a done deal. So there is still hope. And my hope isn't to forgive my crassness, but the crap on the illegals. My hope is we got to protect the constituents who do want the dream of being able to buy a home. What are your thoughts on the potential legal challenge? Do you think it's the right way to go, or do you think it's just delayed and inevitable?
I think us talking about it is what breaks it down for people to understand better the implications. I think it's why are we creating an incentive for people to be here illegally and giving them something else to sort of hold on to so they can, you know, be a homeowner? I mean, we're incentivizing people to be here illegally. And I thought that was something that we were going to, as U.S. citizens, sort of be able to take a stand on and have a real conversation about. So I do, think that the legal issues as they come up are going to be the way that people understand it better. Because I think this is what happens. These conversations happen and someone, sensitive people, because you do find out a lot about Americans, they actually really do care. At the end of the day, there's a lot of people who really care. So they think, oh, the American dream. Oh, I want everyone to. There's a lot of that in this world still, which I think is beautiful and wonderful. I would never want to take that away. But it ends up hurting the American citizens, as you said so well. And so when it comes to these legal issues, I think that's what's going to break it down for people to better understand how it impacts their lives and that there's another way to go about this.
Correct, correct. Now, Gee, what I wanted to ask you is, what about the if an illegal decides, oh, I've had enough of America, I'm going back home, and they have a home loan? I mean, you're not a lawyer, so I don't expect you to have the answer here, but that's a question that kind of occurred to me. Okay, what happens if they head on back home? And that, see, to me, that's what I think of the Clinton crisis, the housing bust. And that was completely different, but I just see a potential a lot of defaults possibly happen, because just because you qualify for a loan, you still have to make that house payment, you know? So what are your thoughts on that possibility?
Well, that's interesting. So you still have to get 80% in a mortgage by the bank, right? So if someone defaults, let's say they move back home, even a legal immigrant, right? Like a legal one might decide to move back home as well. I would presume they would try to sell it. But let's say it's a deportation. Well, they're not going to have enough time to sell. So I would imagine that once the house goes into foreclosure, the bank will take it back. So what happens to the taxpayer 20%, right? That's a good question. I would imagine the state would try to get some claim on that 20% value, or maybe just the straight dollar value if the house appreciates. So I wouldn't be too concerned about that, because the mechanisms are in place to, recover from a situation like that.
I don't know, hearing you say, I wouldn't be too concerned about that. That's what they said about Clinton and his Reinvestment Act. I wouldn't be too concerned about that. Everybody's going to be able to own a home. We're all going to be happy.
All three of us have dealt with politicians. They're just regular people like the three of us, right? So I'm not putting like a lot of intelligence into this bill right here, right?
That's
point
true.
Over here, because it's some other monitor.
I would not call Daryl Issa a regular politician. You know, I would not. I wouldn't even call Marie Waldron. It's funny how, and it's so true, and it's on both sides. It doesn't matter what party you're in. Right. You go in as a middle class, you come out as a millionaire of sorts. So there have been times where, because I'd love to run to help people. I was brought up that way. You know, I was brought up in the era, you better eat every piece of food on that plate because there's people starving, you know, and I always brought up helping my fellow cousins, my family, because they were poor, we weren't, you know, but there are times when I have cynically thought, running for office, yeah, I can get rich too, you know, it's a terrible thought, but in full transparency, I have cynically thought like that too, because it just seems to be the norm, but you're right. They're not any smarter than you or I or Annette or I or anybody else, but they sure do seem to be able to come out a lot richer. I don't want to beat this to death, because we've covered a lot of this. But real quick, Annette, you would think that this would kind of help turn our state more purplish versus the deep blue, these programs that just keep hammering us with taxes. You think $700 a month on an electricity bill, giving illegals the right to be able to take out loans, you think this would help turn the state purple. But what are your thoughts? How will this affect us politically in terms of political demographics in this state? You think it's going to make any headway? Do you think just people just aren't going to care?
Wow, that's a great question. I think that it's these conversations that bring these things to light, and the more people that listen, they start to really think critically about it, and then they see the impact that it has on their life, and that it always ends up being upon the taxpayers' back, which is the most, and that is part of the reason why our electricity bills are so high. I have the same problem with my electricity bill. But what happens? They can make all those investments at Sempra Energy or whatever energy, and then they can never lose. Not like you and I in the stock market. It can go up, it can go down, we can win, we can lose. They don't get to lose. We lose, the ones who are paying our electricity bills. We're the ones who lose on their bad investments every single year, every single month.
Yeah.
That's very frustrating to me. So I think that people are waking up, but a lot of the people, I think, who are at that upper elite echelon, they're so unaffected by the things that everyday Americans are affected by, but they are pushing these agendas. That's what I don't understand, because that, which shows how out of touch they are. They're out of touch with day-to-day living. They're pushing agendas that affect the people in their day-to-day lives, where it make it impossible to pay your electric bills. So like you're like paying a little bit this month and a little bit next month, and then trying to catch up like in month three, maybe if you can. So, but
right.
I think that most people fall into the camp where someone like I fall into, where you're working really hard to put it all together and try to keep your kids in college and make it all work. And that's where like these conversations make a difference, when people understand that these bills and these laws will affect the bottom line.
You know, you're correct. It's like I was listening to you, and I'm like, I'm digesting everything. But sometimes when you put something in blue collar terms, when you said, yeah, the stock, and we have to pay up, I'm like, oh, yeah, I relate to that, you know? But, you know, to your point, I just said this about Mina Kimes. I just hammered her. She's an ESPN, very progressive leftist who spews a lot of lies, garbage, all based on her feelings. And the moment somebody pushes back, she throws out the race card, the woman card, every card out there. And what she fails to realize, and I truly believe this, so I guess in a way I hate saying this because I want to view them as vile, evil people, because that's how much hate they push out towards people they don't care for. But they're so ignorant. They're so naive. They don't understand that their feelings of wanting to feel good about themselves and helping others actually doesn't help. And the reason they get away with feeling that way is because of what you said, Annette. They don't have to worry about that $700. When Mina Kimes is earning, now she lives in Connecticut, but even out here earning a few million a year, she doesn't have to worry about a $700 a month electric bill. You know, they don't have to worry about their kids not being taught math and science and, you know, the STEM in public schools, because they're sending their kids to private schools. And I always, I'll leave this segment with the final word with this story in terms of what you were talking about, Annette. And I've told this story before, but it makes my point so well. When they recalled the district attorney in San Francisco, very progressive, hardcore leftist, and they broke down the voting. We now have the technology, people, to know how each district votes. You know, every district that voted to keep him, this was a DA that was led. It was a revolving door for criminals. They weren't being prosecuted. They weren't being charged. Every elite, rich, upper middle income district voted to keep him. Every poor and working class district in the San Francisco area voted to dump him. You know, so, and it just shows that how out of touch those people who have been successful in life, whether it's hard earned success, meaning they clawed their way to their success, or whether it's inherited, it doesn't matter. They lost so much touch with the regular people, and they don't understand how much, where it may sound nice, oh yeah, we're helping the legals, you know? No, you're putting the burden on the working class. And here's a lie. One more final comment on that is, they never volunteer to pay more money themselves into the taxes. They want all those taxes to be shared by everybody. So the hypocrisy and the ignorance from those who have made it, who are well off, never ceases to amaze me. But even worse, it actually angers me. And I said I would have the last word before we even talk it. Topic G. Any final words? Then we're going to any final words.
So you were asking about how this affects the other states and how this would spread. Well, look at what Kamala Harris is promising, right? She's saying, first-time home buyers, I want to give you $25,000. You know, so she has the red Christmas bag over her shoulder, ready to go around and give gifts to people. Well, in 2019, she also said, if you come here illegally, I want to give you free health care. So at some point, if she wins, she's going to give that $25,000 to first-time home buyers, and then she's going to expand it to let anyone qualify, regardless of your immigration status. So that is very worrisome. I she can't win the presidency. That would be a disaster for our country.
Big John would disagree with me vehemently. There are two sides to it, but as I've told you guys in previous podcasts, I'm scared to death because of voter fraud. There's only one reason for mail-in ballots, and that's for cheating. We did very well with pencil and paper and having one day to go vote. And people forget that your job had no choice but to allow you to go vote that day. So all these lies, well, they got to find time or this, that. No, there was time, and voting is a privilege. They turned it into this vile, evil machine that I have seen firsthand in action with Noriega in Panama, winning handily, election after election after election, and yet the state of Panama, everybody hated the guy, But that, it never ceased to amaze me. I would always run into people who loved it. And I'm like, oh my God, how can you love it? Why? Because they had a job that was usually a state type or government type job. So they didn't feel the pain. And any final words on this topic here before we move on?
No, I mean, I just think that you guys really nailed it. I do. I probably don't have anything good to add.
No worries, then. No worries. So let us move on to an individual. Some people say borders on the line of autism, but on the brilliant side. And that is Mark Zuckerberg of Meta, where I have aptly titled this segment, The Ministry of Truth 2.0. Oh, that's the wrong one. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Zuck Orwell is 1984. Welcome to the Ministry of Truth, where free speech is just a suggestion and Democrats' shadow puppeteers orchestrate nightmarish dance of silence voices. In other words, they're squashing our freedom of speech. And Zuckerberg came out this week through a letter through to a congressman, Jordan, apologizing for the censorship. So let me put up that letter here. Okay. I did get this letter. I hope it's legible to everybody. Share screen. And I will read it. Chairman Jordan, I appreciate, I apologize. I just realized. I hope you guys can hear me. I did not have my microphone. Yeah, my little thing that I spent good money on.
You can hear you, okay. But it sounds way better.
There we go. Chairman Jordan, I appreciate the committee's interest in content moderation on online platforms. As you are aware, Meta has produced thousands of documents as part of your investigation and made a dozen employees available for transcribed interviews. Further to our cooperation with your investigation, I welcome the opportunity to share what I've taken away from this process. There's a lot of talk right now around how the U.S. government interacts with companies like Meta, and I want to be clear about our position. Our platforms are for everyone. We're about promoting speech and helping people connect in a safe and secure way. As part of this, we regularly hear from governments around the world and others with various concerns around public discourse and public safety. In 2021, senior officials from the Biden administration, including the White House, repeatedly pressured our teams for months to censor certain COVID-19 content, including humor and satire. He's referring to memes in that sense, including humor and satire, and expressed a lot of frustration with our teams when we didn't agree. Ultimately, it was our decision whether or not to take content down, and we own our decisions, including COVID-19 related changes we made to our enforcement in the wake of this pressure. I believe the government pressure was wrong, and I regret that we were not more outspoken about it. I also think we made some choices that, with the benefit of hindsight and new information, we wouldn't make today. Like I said to our teams at the time, I feel strongly that we should not compromise our content standards due to pressure from any administration in either direction. And we're ready to push back if something like this happens. Now, that was COVID-19. He goes on to talk about Russian disinformation. And I apologize to the audience, but I think it's important to read his letter. Most people haven't even seen it. Okay, so continuing on. In a separate situation, the FBI warned us about a potential Russian disinformation operation about the Biden family and Burisma in the lead up to the 2020 election. That fall, when we saw a New York Post story reporting on corruption allegations involving then-Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden's family, we sent that story to fact checkers for review and temporarily demoted it while waiting for a reply. It's since been made clear that the reporting was not Russian disinformation, and in retrospect, we shouldn't have demoted the story. We've changed our policies and processes to make sure this doesn't happen again. For instance, we no longer temporarily demote things in the U.S. while waiting for fact checkers. Apart from content moderation, I want to address the contributions I made during the last presidential cycle to support electoral infrastructure. The idea here, okay, so that part he's talking about, he's not going to support candidates like he did before. His final comment on this is, my goal is to be neutral and not play a role one way or another, or to even appear to be playing a role. So I don't plan on making a similar contribution this cycle. So he says, this is a key point here. So I don't plan on making a similar contribution this cycle. I don't plan on making a similar contribution to Psycho. He doesn't say, I'm not making a contribution to any side. I'm just not going to make a similar contribution. What I got out of this whole letter, which is people are like, yeah, it's about time. That's not what I got out of it. I got Eddie Haskell is apologizing because if Trump gets elected, the potential for hearings are there. The potential for whistleblowers finally coming out and not being worried about retribution. Because I'm sorry, for the last 10 to 15 years, whistleblowers have been attacked. They've gone to jail. It's their lives are literally under the gun versus a time when they were a very well protected class. So I think this is him covering his tail more so than coming clean. So Annette, I've got a whole topic listed in questions listed on this, but just real quick, when you hear that letter, what are your initial thoughts?
This is the biggest concern I have right now living in this country is free speech. Yeah, I thought it was devastating. I'm sorry. I thought what you thought, he was protecting himself. Unfortunately, I thought that was why he said what he said when he said it right now, to protect himself potentially for the future. But nothing that I didn't know or suspect. I'm glad it's out there and verified that these things are happening and did happen. I think a lot of people feel that that's a lot of that was happening during COVID. But aren't we all deathly afraid? I am terrified by what is happening to free speech in our country. I think this could happen again. I think what's happening in France is just as scary. That is a part of this, though. That is we can talk about that in conjunction with this. But you asked me what I think about this in general. When I read that, I thought to myself, he's looking out for number one. I get that. So glad it's out there, though, for other people to see. Those things did happen. They are happening. They can happen again. They might be even happening right now, even though he admitted that, you know, they made some decisions to censor.
Correct. And in fact, for the audience out there, you know, the Germans have just started. I mean, they've done it for a little while, but if you say something on social media or something online, they'll open up an investigation on you. And the French said, hold my beer, Germany, as they're doing a little bit more than opening investigations or bringing people in. And the UK says, Germany, France, y'all, the minor leagues, as they are imprisoning people for what they're posting online. And it's not hate speech. Some of these are why are the immigrants getting away with doing this, and we're being attacked for doing it. Those people who question that are being sent to jail. And that's happened here in certain cases as well. I mean, the political prosecution of Donald Trump, whether you like Trump or not. See, this is my issue with people is, you may want this, you may support this because it's Trump. But eventually, what's that saying? You give them a hand, they take it out. Well, they eat their own. Eventually, they're going to come after you who are supporting this today, because eventually you're going to disagree and they'll do the same thing to you. So you are absolutely right. I do have a fear. And before, G, I get to you, this is a very important story because it's true. When I was in Panama in the 90s, at the height of Noriega and the U.S. standoff and the anger and the hatred, being an American citizen but having family that was caught in the middle, and me having the voice I have, I just did not hold back. And I have told this story before in our podcast. I got pretty much jerked and, you know, jacked up, not physically, but metaphorically. And my relatives and friends said, shut up. Shut the bleep up. Because they're like, nothing's going to happen to you, but we could be gone the next day, you know? And that was chilling to me. At first I was angry, but then as I matured, as years went on, it grew into a chill because I saw aspects of that happening here. And I don't, you know, they are still censoring. I have a Facebook group that I manage and, you know, I still see spam. You know, they'll note it as spam. And it's not spam. It's just, in fact, one of the Zuckerberg, this topic, they deemed it as spam. Their fact checkers are progressive leftists. They were, Facebook was part of the group going around confirming the fact that if you took the COVID jab, you would not catch COVID. You know, so this whole play is to me, he's covering his tail. Gee, so in your eyes, what mechanisms can be established to ensure that government influence does not compromise integrity? But let me put a caveat in that. The Supreme Court blocked the case or refused to hear the case, if I'm correct, that challenged the protect our First Amendment rights. And the Supreme Court said, no, the government has a right to go and try to influence social media. You know, so we've already got one strike against it from SCOTUS, you know. So what mechanisms can be established? And can those even hold these people to account, the government?
Well, first I want to go back and push back on you. France didn't tell Germany to hold my beer. They said hold my wine.
There you go.
They're a wine country. And England is the one who said hold my ale. If Elon Musk ever comes to England, he'll be thrown in jail for posting a tweet, which is obscene. We take our First Amendment right here for granted because other countries really don't have it. We're very unique in the world to be able to say what we want to say without being thrown in jail. Now, I want to read the First Amendment. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press. And so what mechanism can be put into place? I mean, definitely nothing by the government. I mean, that would go against the First Amendment, is establishing a law. We'll make a law, right? And then we have to have an honest conversation of, okay, if you are a private media company like Facebook, or like CNN, Kamala News Network, I'm sorry, KNN. can they report what they want to report, right? And so can Zuckerberg say, no, you will not, we will only allow left-wing stuff on our platform. And then we let the free market decide, okay, do we want to allow that? Let me back up. He will lose half his followers, right? And they'll go over to a place like Truth Social. And Truth Social is very much, Twitter for the right. And it's a very small segment of the population that uses it. So it doesn't hold a candle to X. But so what mechanisms can we put in place? I think the free market is the mechanism. And if Zuckerberg wants as many people as possible to use his platform, he will allow free speech, right? So now X is just wide open for everyone. And I, you know, half the time I'm smiling, half the time I'm angry, scrolling on X going, oh, that's a good one. But it really is a bastion of free speech now, but thanks to Elon Musk. So maybe Zuckerberg's seeing that that's the way to do it. And he saw he gained free speech religion at some point and decided, yeah, let's go there. I actually posted this letter on my Facebook, and one of my Facebook friends said, who's in charge of the government at the time? Of the Hunter Biden story, which, okay, Trump was president, but who's in charge of the government? That's a bunch of people, right? 535 in Congress, one president, and 9 justices. But it was the FBI that told Zuckerberg a lie. This is Russian disinformation. And I don't know if Zuckerberg goes, oh yeah, I get it, wink, wink, nod, nod. or whether he really believed it. But
No. It was wink, wink, nod, nod. Let's be real about it. I mean, I'm sorry. When you've seen oppression, you can look at things in a black and white. And it doesn't take a rocket scientist to read between the lines. It's like your friend who was in charge of the government. My take is, tell me how stupid and ignorant you are without telling me how stupid and ignorant you are. Because that's nothing but a false argument. They're just pushing back and saying, hey, it was Trump in charge. Purposely not ignoring the fact of how the government works. I first learned about that, not in Panama, I've seen it, but reading about Japan, how they had articles talking about how the bureaucracy would just wait out the prime ministers and not change and slow everything down. And I'm like, man, how's Japan going to solve that? And this was back in the early 90s, I was reading these articles. Now I'm like, dear God, we had these same problems here. There's a reason they call it the swamp, the deep state. It has nothing to do with conspiracies. It has to do with the size of government and how big a behemoth it's become to where the FBI was working against Trump. You know, in Trump's defense, he allowed some of this to happen. But when you're one man and you're an outsider and it's a whole system built on insiders rewarding themselves with these jobs, it takes a long time to make that change. And Trump's not going to be able to make that change. It's going to take us waking up. And that's my biggest fear, is that we're content to have our heads in the sand. Annette. So how can social media companies like Facebook rebuild the public trust? So, for example, I'm still seeing the censorship, not the censorship, but the and real quick, a story on this. There was a two-way site, a gun site. This is, in fact, Big John and I, before we went into business, I said our website will always be our anchor site. And the reason I say that is because there was this two-way site. If I said the name, I just can't remember. Gee, you would probably remember it. But they built their whole business off there because they had 2 million followers and they were monetizing it. They were making money. They pretty much abandoned their site, you know, right around 2016 or 2015. Facebook whacked them, just removed their page. And then 2 weeks later, they were out of business. Why? Because you can't rely on something you don't control to build your business on at the end of the day, you know. So my point being is, I've never trusted Facebook or any platform because of that. But that said, what can they do to rebuild trust in that? Not just Facebook, but other sites. LinkedIn's another one.
Well, we have no faith in them, right? And I would argue also that they have no faith in us. They have no faith in us to believe as human beings that we can decide for ourselves and be the arbiters of our own information and have autonomy over our own information. So they don't have faith in us. The government doesn't have faith in us. I think we can have a very strong argument against if the government actually cares about its people. And you can say that, William, you can speak to that better than anybody. Now, I would argue, I used to not feel that way about the United States. I used to feel that we had a government that did care about its people. I argue to my daughters all the time today that I don't feel that way anymore. I don't feel it's looking out for me. And if it's going to infringe upon free speech, then it's really not looking out for me. So how can Facebook and these other companies make a comeback after admitting that they allowed allowed censorship to happen on their platforms? You mean, is the statement that he made going to go far enough? I doubt it. I think there's going to be some heavy skepticism, and maybe people are going to have to be able to that's an excellent question. I don't know how they're going to make a comeback, because I still feel like I have a heavy skepticism. I'm still having a lot of faith in X, as G does, because I'm seeing a lot of things being spewed on both sides, stuff that makes me want to gag, stuff that I'm like, double thumbs up on this. So I'm seeing all kinds of conversation that seems to be people aren't trying to stop it from happening. Even the stuff that I really don't like and I don't want to engage with at all. How they're going to get the public back involved and back engaged and having faith in them and trusting them again is going to be, I think, a bit of a long haul. That takes time.
I don't think they will. I think the first thing, and they will not do this because it's a big PR game for them, is they've got to get rid of their fact checkers. Their fact checkers are leftist organizations, you know, so that alone negates it. You know, I don't think they should have any fact checkers, because a conservative fact checker will be more biased, will be closer to the middle, I believe. I myself as a conservative, it's like I always reference Big John because that's who I talk to daily. You know, I'm always like, yeah, the Supreme Court, I pull my hair out at them. But there's times where I pull my hair and I know I disagree with a decision because I want it to go not the constitutional way, but my actual values way, and they follow the constitution. So I will always say a conservative is closer to the middle than a progressive who wants to do what's right. What's that saying? The road, the hell is paved through goodness or
road to hell is paved with good intentions.
Good intentions.
Yes. And that's the problem with progressivism in my eyes. And conservative too, but we tend to have a greater balance. So, now I'm not going to get into detail, but some of the issues for potential lawsuits, First Amendment violations, the big one is always Section 230, abuse of power, conspiracy to violate civil rights, the classic shareholder lawsuits. There's regulatory. So there's a whole bunch of things, but in essence, that's on a potential horizon too. I mean, because this letter opens up potential lawsuits. It's your classic, you never apologize, because the apology is an admission of guilt. So a lot of people are going to look at this and they're going to go to their lawyers. How might these potential lawsuits and regulatory changes, if they come, shape the future of content moderation and government tech company relationships? To me, these potential lawsuits should scare the bejesus out of them. So when government comes knocking, they keep that door locked and keep government out. But what's your take and what this could create for the social media platforms?
Well, one, I think we should protect any whistleblowers, allow some kind of whistleblowing from an internal internal employee of an organization to say, hey, we had an all hands meeting and we were told we need to support Kamala. So we need to deep six any stories about, so this whole CNN interview yesterday, I hear CNN interviewed her for 41 minutes. It was only 18 minutes of footage. So I wonder what happened to the 22 minutes or 23 minutes, right? So a whistleblower should come forward and say, yeah, those other 23 minutes are so bad. You have to cut it out.
Oh, my God. The 18 minutes we saw was so bad.
Well, right, but that was the best of what was so bad, right? So let's have something where whistleblowers are protected, right? But I don't want more regulation over media and how to report it, and this is what you have to do or whatnot. But I think the threat of having to be tied up in court for months and months and years should be enough for a media organization to go, no, we just want to say, we don't want to censor anything because we don't want to go through this mess, this headache, right? So I actually don't mind seeing all these lawsuits. I just hope no more government regulation comes out of it, because we're just going to get to that point where we're bridging on the First Amendment. And that's going to be a problem. And maybe that's driven by people on our side of the aisle, and that's the problem.
You know, this guy who I actually saw at the meeting we were all at the Republican meeting, he leans more libertarian. You know him. I won't say his name, but you pointed him out to me. There's a tall guy. He was talking about the free market, and it just hit me. This isn't on you, Big John, because Big John's a libertarian. But he was talking about free market, this free market, that, and it just hit me. Well, all right, let's have a free market. Remove Section 230. But if you remove Section 230, there's going to be chaos, good and bad, you know? So there, you know, and people don't understand that. I didn't understand that at first until somebody explained to me, well, William, 230 actually protects this, this, and this, which is kind of good. And, you know, so we don't really have a free market. So people keep talking about let the free market. We've never had a free market. The strong take from the weak since the dawn of civilization, they've always controlled the markets. So I agree, let's get to as close to a free market as we can. But it's kind of hard with the way our world is built, especially around tech and technology. It's not a physical type scenario. I don't know. It's just these lawsuits. I think you're right, G. I think what we can hope for out of these lawsuits is for them to kind of scare them straight, you know, right. to scare them to go, let's just, cause that's how I ran my business at KFFL. My fantasy sports company was in the top three in all fantasy sports. And I always did everything in the middle, meaning we did not have hate, but I allowed people to say their say. You know, we use a common sense approach. So that's what I think these social media platforms. Now, we're not going to get into it, but one thing facing Facebook is they are dying a death by a million cuts because they have a 2 billion worldwide user base. But in the States, they are no longer growing like they were when they first became popular in 2009. The younger demographic has abandoned them. So I think this is also Zuckerberg looking at the long-term future of his company. And I apologize, G, I don't want to cut you out of the conversation, but I want to keep moving. But Ms. Annette, do you have any final words on this topic before we move on to our final topic?
Only to agree with you that my daughters who are in their college and early 20s think that Facebook is for dinosaurs, for sure. So that was a correct assumption. No, I would only say that we've lost our way when it comes to some of these conversations. And as I said, we've lost people, the government has lost faith in us, and they think that we don't have the ability any longer to think for ourselves and discern information and make good choices. They would prefer to make the choices for us. And that is the bottom line for me that absolutely frustrates me. And I think they piled us all together to think that we're stupid. And I think that too much law is a very bad thing. Also,
I think we have too much law.
I think there should be guiding principles and there should definitely be law, but writing more and more law. I think I had mentioned this in one of the earlier podcasts that I watched a really great interview with Neil Gorsuch, who said we're writing too much law. Yes. If he renders and it becomes meaningless, it gets us all trapped in a myriad of legal battles and lawsuits that everyone gets tangled up in for years and years and years. And some of them are not even relevant anymore. So I think we've gone too far with that as well.
You know, I'm a bit more cynical. I have truly come to believe that the founding fathers were outliers. They were an exception to those who would lord over us. Because people forget, these were elitists. You know, they were the upper class. But they saw what would make a great country. And we talked about this quote before, a couple of shows ago or last week, you know, what Benjamin Franklin, you know, what kind of government we have, you know, Republican, we can keep it. But I think you remove those people and everybody who lords over us, I mean, they came from a feudal system, from a king, a monarchy, where it was a caste system. You were a peasant. It wasn't just you. It was generation after generation after generation. And what's scary is to see progressives on X. I saw a tweet. You know, the feudal system wasn't that bad. You know, and Big John has a great interview with Wilfred Riley, who I call this generation's Thomas Sowell. He posted, he responded to the guy. He goes, you say that because you view yourself in that like 0.08 or 0.8 or 8% of the ones who would lord over the peasants, you know? And Wilfred Riley's whole point was, you're not part of that 8%. You're going to be with the peasants, you know? So be careful what you wish for. But I wish I had.
Can I ask you a question, William? Just this one time, can I ask you a question really quick? Because you said that about the founding fathers. So one of the things Neil Gorsuch said in his interview was he felt that the masses, so the majority, the big majority of like the population, they do end up on the right with the right answer. Like, he has faith in the people. Have you lost your faith in the people?
Yes, but G's right. G is right. I have lost my faith in the people because in fact, I think it was Big John said it in his libertarian podcast the other night. We are still exponentially much better in terms of the way our lives live compared to third world nations. So we will take a lot, but G's absolutely right what he said last week with his Winston Churchill quote. You know, Americans will eventually do the right thing. I just think we are generations away from us hitting that rock bottom to the point where will be past the point of no return. That's my fear. And yes, I am cynical because we as human beings want structure. We want to be told how to live. You don't see us living off the grid on our own. Those are outliers, you know, and those people are castigated. They're looked down upon. They're called, what are the people, you know, the ones who always hoard the food, the water and all that. I forgot you said the term, last week or 2 weeks ago. But they're the outliers. Most of us, we like our electricity. We will give up our rights for electricity, for hot water. You know, when I go to Panama, and it drives my relatives on their nuts because I go, I appreciate the fact that I had to put the hot water in the bucket or the water in the bucket in, as I'm showering, put it over my head. It makes me remember my family came from. It's a value. I truly in my heart appreciate that because I never forget where we came from. You know, we will give up half our rights to make sure we have hot water. We will give up, I hate to sound crass, we give up our rights to have a toilet and toilet paper. You know, we will give up a right. So yes, I do become cynical. Look at how many conservative parents are there that they whine to us. And I get so angry at them. I go, you're whining because you sent your kid as a conservative to college and he's come back a leftist. I go, well, why don't you cut him off? Why don't you make him get a job? Why don't you tell him or her to pay their own way? Well, I can't. He's my kid. I pull my hair out. My wife gets sick of me. Give it a rest because I just start complaining about friends of ours and that's with their kids. You know, I had just a friend a couple of weeks ago, William, I'm a conservative. And they think like this. And my wife warns me, shut up. Don't say a word. Don't say. And I'm like, and eventually I'm like vomiting about you. I can't help but go, you're the parent. Why don't you just tell them? You know, I got so angry at one parent. He said, yeah. You know, my son's he's a prodigy. He's an independent thinker. And I'm thinking, your son is in mid to late 20s, and he's living at home off your dime. And you're saying he's an independent thinker. I don't think so. You know, but you can't say that to the parent. But that's how, so I have become cynical because we give up so much of our freedom, so much of our rights for comfort. You know, so does that mean I have given up hope? No, but you guys have heard me over the last few podcasts. Man, that depresses me. It depresses me. And my depression is at my fellow man. It's like Big John and I, one reason we bond is we've given up certain aspects in life that would have made us a lot more money than what we have. And so we've created our own lots. And there's times I do regret that, you know, but I don't regret my life, but there's, God, I wish I could have done it differently. You know, we all think like that. But we both realize we're outliers. We are not the norm. I was, you know, G's probably still a rising star in the party. My star dimmed when I started voicing my opinions to people. I just had a friend of ours that G knows too. They just unfriended. I didn't know they unfriended me on Facebook a few weeks ago because I believe what I said about Marie Waldron, you know. So, you know, you have to – understand there is a potential for a retaliation for whatever by speaking your own peace. And we as human beings will hold our own peace. And my final comment on this before we move on is at the height of the Revolutionary War, it only had 45% of support. When the Revolutionary War started, it was like 10 to 12% of support for that Revolutionary War. Most people were happy being under the thumb of King George, and they may have hated it, but they were okay with paying those taxes. It's the few who have given us our freedoms of today. It's the few who will always stand up. Look, whether you hate or like Trump, the guy is a billionaire who could have just gone off and enjoyed the rest of his life. But I truly believe, for better or for worse, because he is crass. He does things where I pull my hair out. But I truly believe he loves this country. I truly believe he wants this country to be better. Now, that said, you know, he's done some things where I shake my head, dude, you don't do that. That's wrong. But we're all human. You know, we all make mistakes. It's how I had TDS in 2015. In 2016, after a couple of months, and I saw what he did with regulations, I became a big supporter. I'm starting to drone on, so I apologize. But I hope that answers your question. I have faith in humanity, but I think we're getting to a point of no return because government has become a behemoth. And when you have a black, what do they call it? But where money goes in the budget, that we don't know where it goes, in the trillions. You know, that shows how big of a behemoth we've got it. All right, friends, I apologize.
One thing to say, I'm not one of the 65% that was a loyalist because of my guitar right here. So that's love the guitar. It is a guitar, but...
There you go.
American through and through.
Yeah, for those of you that don't know, Def Leppard they had just hit after hit back in the 80s and 90s, you know. And even after the guy lost his arm in an accident, they were still cranking them out. You know, all right, so moving on from Def Leppard there. The Ministry of Truth 2.0, Google's $250 million journalism support deal, ushers in California's brave new media world. I brought this back up as a topic because we talked about this 2 weeks ago. And we were all under the conclusion, nah, it's not going to happen or this or that. And then, boom, we saw this deal come through, you know. So to give the audience an overview, California lawmakers reached a deal with Google to support journalism in the state of California. Google has agreed to pay $250 million over 3 years to support local journalism. And the deal avoids the implementation of a proposed leak tax on tech companies. An agreement was announced on August 21st, last week. So the leak tax is, and G, you can help me out. You've done a little research. The leak tax is they were going to be taxed for links of news stories that Google Google search engine was providing end users like ourselves, correct?
Yeah, and whatever ad revenue that they earned off of clicking on a link, they would pay a certain percentage to, I believe, the content creator, which would be the company who employed the journalist for that content. So okay. That was the original idea.
Okay, so. This deal is a done deal. And we'll get into it a little bit here, but how might this deal with Google in California set precedent for other tech giants and other states? I personally think it's a no-go. You're going to get resistance from other tech giants. Eventually, this is going to fall apart. I mean, think about it. $250 million with California over X amount of years. Think of now you got 49 other states to deal with, you know? This other states are looking at their conference going, hey, I like this. What do you think, G?
Well, I mean, you know, when we first talked about it, I had a different view of it. But now I'm torn on this because a journalist, and we will all admit that most of them are left-wing journalists, they are working, right? They're contributing to the fabric of the society. We might argue whether their point of view is a good thing or bad, but they are working, so they're earning their money. And for a tech giant to come in and say, oh, thank you, let me just link that here, and they don't get anything additional for it.
Okay, G, I got a question on that, though.
Yeah.
How does leaking an article hurt the newspaper? I mean, honestly, when I leak an article, at times it takes me to papers I have never heard of, and I'll bookmark that paper moving forward. Now, it's up to the paper. If you don't want me to see that article for free, don't have it free on your site. So I don't understand how Google search engine, and I'm being legit here, it's buttons. Like, how are they the bad guy by just providing the link?
Right. No, I don't understand why it would be a big deal unless you're Googling and you're earning money off the search results, right? And then you click on the article, but they've already made money on the search results, right? So there's a money for that people pay to rank their search results higher in the search results. And then there's a click through, payment.
That's paid advertising. That's a business model.
Right. So, no, I get it. I don't really have an opinion on this because I can actually see both sides of the whole issue. I just think at some point Google realized they're going to lose, right? So Google decided, well, let's just pay, I think over 5 years they're paying $160 million into this fund, which is going to be $250 million entirely. Where I do have a problem with it is the rest of that, which is about $100 million, is coming from the three of us and the other 35 million Californians, right? That's where I have a problem. Why are we paying our taxpayer money to fund these journalists, right? Aren't we already doing that through our subscriptions? Aren't we already doing that through the advertisements when we open up the paper?
I agree.
Most of these are local papers, right?
No, I agree. So, Annette, how can supposedly an independent administrator is going to determine where the money goes, and it's been earmarked for diversity, meaning minority type businesses or and things of that. So that alone gives me problems because as a Latino, I've seen hardworking white people, hardworking black people, hardworking Latinos, Asians, whatever you want to call it, and I've also seen a lot of lazy asses in every group too. And to me, it's like when you start, to me, that's discrimination. Oh, only this group can see the money. But all that aside, I had to throw my two cents in there. But all that aside is, how can an independent administrator ensure fair and effective distribution of the funds? I mean, what metrics? And I'm not saying that you have the answers, but how are you going to determine, how are you going to play King David here? With the president, yes. With the wife, you know, with the mother.
Yes, like who are you? This is my problem with it all, is that who thinks that they can be the person to make the big decision about how it's all going to be evened out, level out the playing field, make it more equitable. I'm going to be the one because I know better than you, which is like the problem that I have with so many of these issues. Someone thinks that they know better and they're going to be the one to be the distributors of making somehow everything all equal. We'll make sure that things get distributed in the right way so everybody gets their voices heard. That is an impossible, if not achievable, first of all. That's never going to happen. The way it's laid out, in my opinion, is very convoluted. I guess I was thinking, and maybe you guys can correct me on this, I was thinking, so did Google decide that it'd be cheaper to do it this way than to be paying for a tax link?
Yes, that's what, I think so. I mean, we are speculating, but that's kind of, yeah. We're like, they're like, let's just pay them. I think they view it as a delaying tactic because when you get 49 other states that are going to come knocking on Google's door, those are separate deals. Maybe Google's lobbying group's going to try to nationalize it and just pay one big tax under the government. But that gets to my next issue. I'll start with you on that one is we talked about the free market with the last segment, you know. To me, this reminds me of the radio versus television. We're trying to stave off and keep alive an industry that's dying. The industry itself won't die, meaning we're always going to need news reporters. But how the market works is passé, meaning the newspaper industry is passé. And these same industries created this mess by offering everything free. You give a hand, they take an arm. Today's generation, the last couple of generations, there, and I saw this firsthand, you know, having a subscription service. I had 60,000 subscribers, $30 a pop, you know, and when I saw the company, they did away with that. And I said, you guys are idiots because, you know, this new generation, they think everything's free. And we are in that generation now. Subscription services are slowly coming back into play. But the people who want to be saved are the ones who allow this to happen. So I think it's also a way to control the media, government control. So let's focus on that because that was our whole issue the last time is I think this administrator is going to be just like the FTC or the FTA, I forget it, where it's like three Democrats, two Republicans, three Republicans, two Democrats. You know, there's always somebody in power. And whoever controls that administrator is going to control the political discourse at these publications because if you disagree with the government and what you're printing, that those 30 people in that newsroom of 40 people that are being supported by this tax, those jobs are going to go away because they're going to cut off the funding because that administrator is going to find a reason not to give you your money. That's what I think is going to happen. Annette, what do you think of my thought process with that?
I totally agree with you. That's what scares me about it, is that somebody else is going to be deciding potentially the news that we'll be digesting and reading, and then they're through that lens that they think that's going to be automatically, they have a bias because everybody has a little bit of a bias. I would tend to maybe, I don't know, we could go on and on about that bias. But I think that is what will happen. And I think just like everything else, we're getting into very dangerous categories. I mean, very dangerous territory. I want to say something about Google. When I was reading and thinking about this, I thought in some ways, it doesn't even seem that fair to Google. It seems like we're, do you know what I'm saying? It's like, how are we allowed as a government to slap their hands and make them do this? That doesn't seem like that's fair. either.
Right. I mean, all they have to do, make the law illegal and let Google deal with it. And Google can choose not to provide those links. You know, gee, you said something a couple of shows ago, something to do with the schools. Yeah, the states, California, it gives the school boards all the autonomy they want as long as they follow what the states want. This is what I see happening here. And I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off, but gee, did you have anything to add to that?
Well, I would imagine that the links is in order for someone to help find the article. So a play that Google could have made is just said, okay, we're not going to serve up any news articles, right? And you go directly to CNN.com or wherever. But I think the problem with that is that a lot of people go to Google and immediately type in Donald J. Trump, Kamala Harris, what's the latest news, right? And that's where they go. So maybe Google didn't want to lose being the first place to go, right? Because if you're not the first place to go, then the first place you're going to go is CNN or Fox News or MSNBC or whatever your choice of media is. So maybe it was Google's calculation that, okay, if we pay this $160 million, we still get to make a billion off that, right? Rather than losing a billion in revenue or whatever the number is.
But still, when you add 49 more states, and on top of that, Australia and Canada are gouging them, and other countries are going to start gouging them. To me, this is a losing proposition, and eventually, I think this is what will eventually kill it. But that said, the final point or question on this is, how can democratic societies ensure that government support for journalism doesn't compromise the media's role as a watchdog? I don't think it can. I think this leads to a total control of government in creating disinformation. You know, I mean, CNN is already in bed with the Democrat Party. MSNBC, NBC, ABC. These are roles I used to only see in dictatorships. But now we see these companies voluntarily going along with their ideological beliefs over doing what's right. But now you're talking about government actually forcing you. So is there anything we can do to keep that from happening? I don't think so. Gee, I'll give you the word, and then you can have the last word on that.
I just watched this show. I was looking it up as you were talking. Hitler and the Nazis, The Evil on Trial. So this is on Netflix. If you have a Netflix subscription, you got to watch it. It's maybe six episodes. So what was interesting about this, it was from the viewpoint of a reporter from San Francisco who moved over there, I believe it was in 1932, when the Nazis came into power, right?
Right.
And he saw how society changed. And he also saw how his reporting of it had to change as well, and how it went through government censorship. And he'd have to go through the Nazi publication, but, you know, Goebbels' propaganda arm. He'd have to get all the news articles changed and reviewed by them. And he was able to keep a private journal, of what was really going on. And then he would publish these articles, but then his journal, I mean, he's the one who wrote the Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, right? In the 1950s, I believe. So the same guy. But anyways, that's the danger of this, like you said, is you run the risk of, okay, if I'm going to get money from this quasi-governmental arm, I need to make sure that that person is happy, right? So I need to publish articles that, and this is not, you know, approval or censorship or anything, but I need to produce articles where he won't give me a call and say, or she, give me a call and say, don't do that again. We don't criticize Governor Newsom, right? So that's my fear, is that in order for the money to flow, you got to play by their rules or by their unspoken rules.
Correct. I agree with that. And Annette, to add to that, it wasn't just the print industry, the movie industry as well had to fall in line. But some of that's kind of already happening, Annette. So, for example, 99.9% of my Rolodex of people who I help their careers in the fantasy sports industry, they've lost my phone number because I'm a proud conservative. I go and I talk what I believe, and that goes against the grain. A friend of mine told me, Yahoo, he goes, we're talking about Yahoo, he goes, they'll never
return your call anymore. And these are companies that told me, if you ever want to get back in the game, give us a call. You know, now they won't return my call. So it is happening in a way, but for the newspaper industry, is there anything that we can do to keep the government from becoming Nazi-esque? Because, you know, good and well, a Gavin Newsom mentality, Jerry Brown mentality, Nancy Pelosi mentality, this California authoritarian mentality will permeate into the news media industry if the government's cutting the local journalists a check. What are your thoughts? Is there anything we can do to stop that, or anyone?
Anything we can do. You're going to really hate my answer. I think the only thing that we can do is raise our children to think for themselves. And I think education does play a really important role in that. But I don't see how we combat some of these problems until we have not just open conversations, but our education system is a really big part of it. Teach history. How about that? Don't teach that's why we have these fights in the school board level about history and how we're teaching history. How come I grew up believing that Christopher Columbus was a great guy and my daughters think he was a villain? I mean, I think that is all in the teaching of history. So how we teach history, what we teach in history, that obviously shapes the way our children think, and it shapes the way then we're going to end up voting and talking about these things and our understanding of the world around us. I don't know what we can do about it, except be really thankful that there's someone is a decent enough human being right now or cares about free speech like Elon Musk, who's actually willing to put his neck on the line and sort of be hated by a lot of people. I see bumper stickers that are bad about him, and he's willing to put his neck on the line and have like a platform like X. He's willing to fight for and defend free speech. So I feel a deep gratitude toward that. But what can we actually do? I mean, these are the conversations I have in my house all the time. This is what I think is important in education right now.
And I again, you asked me about, you know, what I think of the future. It's like education is indoctrination right now, and your kids think that because they've been told everything evil about Columbus, whether true or not. There's two sides. Columbus's brother was a vile, evil man to Panamanians. They settled one of the compounds. In fact, that's where they were at when a lot of when the Queen of England or of Spain was finally, you know, dropping the hammer on them. They were camped out in Panama. But I don't look at Columbus that way. I look at him as, hey, he's an explorer. It takes some big cojones to go out into the open sea, not knowing where you're going to wind up at, you know? And so that's how I look at him. But there's always good and bad. And my issue with what you said isn't what you said as much as, well, when you get a big lie called the 1619 Project, which has been proven to have one lie after another as revisionist history being taught, when you purposely ignore saying, Barack Hussein Obama and just say Barack Obama because you don't want to tie the Hussein to Saddam Hussein just for political purposes. I mean, that's not history, you know? I fear what's being taught, and I am all for homeschooling right now. You know, get your kids out of the greatest thing that COVID did for us that was good. It showed us, it proved me right. It proved me to go to everybody. See, I told you, when everybody would sit there saying, oh, I love the teachers. It's the teachers union. And I'm like, who's voting for these teachers unions, administrators? And who's the one teaching those kids? They're not teaching. COVID showed that these teachers were indoctrinating and not teaching. Now, people, I think G, you weren't on the show at the time. G told me that with Craig that, because Craig's on the school board too, that those teachers are in the minority. I find that hard to believe based off what we saw during COVID, you know. And if they are in the minority, they're that small minority that dominates the majority, you know, because you look at all these lesson plans, all these courses now, you know. It's do we really need a banana to show how to peel it and how to put a condom on to a 6-8-year-old? Or 8-year-old, no, you know. So we've kind of lost our way in education, but we are battling back. That has fun. COVID did bring that to the forefront, and for that, I am happy for COVID to have done that. And with that, that kind of concludes this show. Next week, if we get more information on it, I'm hoping to talk about the school situation of the illegal immigrants wanting to board the school bus, because that is every parent's nightmare, whether it was innocent reasons or whatnot, to have grown men entering a bus full of young kids. So, before I let this topic go, though, G, any final words on this Google California deal?
No, I mean, I don't. No, I think I've said my piece.
And Annette, any final words?
Nope.
And there we have it. So, Miss Annette, before we let everybody go, tell us where we can find you. And once again, I'm going to sound like a broken record, but I want to make sure they know about it every week. Tell us a bit about your book as well.
Look how I added my little – I did – wait, where did it go? It was, oh, yeah, there it is.
Right there.
yes, I wrote the book Where Fairy Tales Go. It's a memoir about, you know, my injury, my life, raising five daughters and – almost 30 years of marriage, and, you know, I say it's a love story. It sort of is. And, you know, that's – thank you for letting me talk about it for a second.
And for the audience, you know, I was pumping up Big John and his show and all that, and then Annette goes, oh, yeah, Charlie Rose interviewed me. Talk about deflating us like that.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes.
Oh, I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding. So, Mr. G, tell us a little bit about yourself there and where we can find you.
Yeah. So there it is, RSF. G on X and Truth Social, and RSF is where I live, and G is my name. So that's where you can find me.
And to everybody else, you can find this podcast and other podcasts. You can find our libertarian podcast, our sports podcast, and my pop culture podcast. I just did another podcast. You can find that at grumblingsmedia.com, as well as our social media platforms on YouTube, on Rumble, on Apple, Pandora, and Spotify under the profile Grumblings Media. So everybody, thank you for showing up. Please make sure you like the podcast and you share the podcast. And until next time, I am William Del Pilar. This is Fired Up, and I bid you adieu.